It's Wednesday, November 1st, 2023, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. In conflicts, verbal or actual, there's always the incentive to maximize the harms inflicted by opponents. If you can redefine a slight as an attack, you do so. If you can further take an actual attack and call it a calamity, the incentives are there. The limitations on such conflation are concepts like credibility. But as we become more and more ideologically siloed, who's there to impose credibility? Credibility becomes less defined as what actually happened and more defined as what the audience eagerly wants to hear happened. So here on The Gist, I've noted the conflation of annoyance to threat and threat to harm in the past, misgivings and unease. That's one thing. These days, they're all described as a lack of safety. It's very hard not to use this language. It works. And like I said, no one's there checking you on it. In America, as passions explode, inspired by literal explosions in Gaza and Israel, there are undeniable linguistic and mental dangers. Here's a Cornell undergraduate who would not go on camera making a statement to CBS News.
How can you think about your classes or anything? It seems so mundane when your life is literally being threatened.
Literally in this case is well used. In her case, it's not an exaggeration to talk about threats. There is a good reason to feel unsafe at Cornell. A literal crime was committed.
As state police stand guard outside the Cornell Center for Jewish Living, the U.S. Attorney for the Northern District of New York says university junior 21-year-old Patrick Dye has been arrested for posting anti-Semitic threats online, including, if you see a Jewish person on campus, follow them home and slit their throats.
But elsewhere, the claim of unsafety has been advanced not based on a literal actual threat, but over sloganeering. I would say odious sloganeering on the part of the pro-Palestinian movement. This chant, which is the most ubiquitous chant of the pro-Palestinian crowd, was heard on the Atlanta campus of Emory University.
From the river to the sea! From the river to the
sea! ANF, Atlanta News First, interviewed an undergraduate.
At the event, they cheered from the river to the sea, which, you know, we should stop saying that means anything different than calling for genocide for Jews throughout Israel.
I understand. It's disturbing. I understand the clear implications are that Israel should not exist. I understand the reasonable conclusion is to believe that those chanting it think that really nothing's out of bounds to achieve the goal of Israel not existing. I know the ADL defines it as anti-Semitic, and many take it as something so close and akin to a call to genocide, let's just call it genocide. Let's just hear that that chant is saying kill all Jews. But slit throats is a literal call to violence. And from the river to the sea is a political slogan with extremely discomforting implications if you're an Israeli or a supporter of Israel, but it's less than a literal threat. And calls to expel or punish chanters need to be rejected. The president of Emory, my alma mater, did issue a statement, a fine statement. There was a protest on our Atlanta campus by members of the Emory community. Throughout the event, anti-Semitic phrases and slogans were repeatedly used by speakers and chanted by the crowd. I cannot be more clear. This kind of rhetoric has no place at Emory. I'm appalled by this behavior. And there we should leave it. Appalled. As Emory's president, Greg Fenves, said, Cornell graduate Greg Fenves, Jew Greg Fenves. But also college president who oversees highly charged emotions and has to navigate everyone's right to free speech, but doesn't have to intercede on behalf of everyone's right not to be offended, even horribly offended. On the show today, there's going to be a jailbreak. Actually, there was, has been quite a few in Philadelphia. But first, Laura Meckler. She's a Washington Post reporter covering education, and in her new book, she tells the story of Shaker Heights, Ohio, a town that has tried really, really hard to get racial integration right. Has it worked? Well, that's the story that Laura Meckler is going to tell up next. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters, and hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Shaker Heights, Ohio, is a suburb of Cleveland that consciously tried to avoid the fates of many inner ring suburbs. Things like segregation, white flight, plunging home values. Shaker Heights, the citizens in Shaker Heights, said, "We're not going to let this happen to us. We're going to not be a segregated community as best as we can. We are going to try to educate our black residents and white residents thoroughly, and we're not going to drive out black residents." So, what are the results of this experiment? It's actually a mixed picture, but it's well documented in the new book, Dreamtown, by Laura Meckler. Shaker Heights and the Quest for Racial Equity is the subtitle. Laura Meckler is a writer for The Washington Post and a Shaker Heights native. Hello, welcome to The Gist.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I think if you're from Shaker, no one's casually from Shaker Heights, are they? I mean, people, if you find out someone's from Shaker Heights, they will always go on about all the people from Shaker Heights. You know, Molly Shannon's from Shaker Heights. And, you know, Andy Borowitz from Shaker Heights. And of course, Paul Newman or Kid Cudi, depending on generation. I mean, or is this just the impression I have, having once met one person from Shaker Heights and never having heard the end of it?
Well, we are a proud bunch. It's true. I think there is a lot of sort of inherent pride and identity that goes with being from Shaker Heights. Part of that stems from what you were just talking about, setting up in terms of a sense of a place that's really tackled issues of race. Part of it is a sense that it's just a really beautiful, wonderful community, an excellent school district. There's all sorts of things that we pride ourselves on. And I guess we're not really lacking in the self-esteem department.
Yeah. So let us talk about what your book mostly centers on, which is how to tackle the issue of race. Was there a time when Shaker Heights seemed to be veering towards the direction that so many other suburbs were veering after World War II? There was a large, first there was an influx into the suburbs, then there was a gutting out of those suburbs, and things like racial anxiety and white flight was a part of that. Was that about to happen to Shaker Heights at some point?
Yeah, I mean, to set the stage, I mean, Shaker was founded as a very elite, wealthy white community at the turn of the 20th century. So, you know, heading into this period that you're talking about, we have a well-established, affluent community that is pretty much overtly racist. The few times that black families tried to get in, they were basically drummed out. But then in the 1950s, mid-50s, we did see a few black families start to arrive into this one neighborhood called Ludlow. And at first, it was exactly what you said and exactly what happened so many other places, you know, the beginning of white flight. Quickly, the neighborhood started to turn over, and that was due to a variety of factors. One is that there was such a dearth of suburban, good suburban housing for middle-class black families that when an area opened up, there was sort of a rush and a huge demand for it. So you had this huge demand side. And then you also had this incredibly destructive and racist real estate industry and banking industry that was helping along the flipping of these neighborhoods, doing things called, that was known as blockbusting, where you go around and scare people and white people into selling. And it actually was hard. Initially you couldn't get a bank loan to move into a white neighborhood if you were black. And then once the neighborhood started to change, you couldn't get a loan to move in to the neighborhood if you were white, because suddenly it was risky. It was a risky investment. Banks didn't want to be part of it. So there was a lot of things going on. And then, yes, initially that was the initial story in Ludlow in the beginning.
How could anyone stand up to these structural forces, these tides that washed over so many other communities?
I mean, this is what is such a remarkable story about what these people did. So it started, the very beginnings of this actually came with another one of these incredibly racist moments, where one of the first black families building a house, their garage while it was being built was firebombed and destroyed. And there were white people living in the neighborhood who were so upset about this, you know, just incredibly unsettled. Like, we don't want this. This is not who we are. And in fact, on the cold January morning, when the crews were there to clean up, a bunch of white people in the neighborhood showed up with cookies and coffee for the crew. And, you know, I'm sure they enjoyed the coffee and the cookies, but it was really the message that mattered there, was that they were sending that said, you know, we are welcoming. Still, you know, there was white flight beginning for all the reasons that we just talked about, but there was then the beginnings of a community association where black people and white people living in the neighborhood who didn't want to see this happen. These white folks who didn't want to leave their neighborhood, they liked it there. And the black families moving in weren't looking for that either. They wanted an integrated neighborhood as well. And they got together, started out with block clubs, and it evolved into a full-formed community association. And what they did was they essentially replicated the services of the real estate industry themselves. They advertised their neighborhood as an integrated neighborhood that was embracing diversity. They had parties, house hunting parties, where they would invite prospective buyers, white prospective buyers, I should say, to come for cocktails and hors d'oeuvres. And then they would show them, like personally escort them to houses that were available, that were on the market. They would recruit, they would go to businesses in Cleveland and say, hey, when you have new recruits coming here, bring them to our neighborhood. We have houses for sale. They even created a company that offered second mortgages so they would get some financing. So they did all of these things to try to essentially do what the system was not doing. And they kind of manifested success, to be honest. They would go out there and say it was working until it kind of did.
Were the efforts mainly to reassure and buttress the concerns of white people, or was it outreach to black people too?
It was not outreach to black people at all. There were a lot of black people arriving on their own. So left to their own devices, there were plenty of black buyers. So what they were trying to do was balance it, so counteract that. And it should be said that the black families living there were supportive of this too, although it was a little difficult for some of them because they were essentially discouraging their own friends and family from moving into the neighborhood because they were trying to maintain racial balance. But what maintaining racial balance meant was recruiting white people. So all of the work was towards getting white people to stay and to buy.
And so what about in the schools? It worked out more or less. They countered the forces, the real estate forces that presented themselves so many other places. But now you have the question of how to run the schools, how to educate the kids. You could have very segregated elementary schools and an integrated high school that didn't work. How'd they figure it out?
So this idea of the housing kind of spread to other neighborhoods in Shaker, and it was kind of going that way for a while. And then in the mid-60s, a new superintendent arrived named Jack Lawson, and he looked at the fact that there was one elementary school called Moreland. This is the next neighborhood over, that where really there had been rapid white flight, and the school itself was 88% black in 1970. And now, so keep in mind, we're, you know, 16 years past Brown v. Board. Desegregation is being fought against all over the country. People are pushing back on it. There are court orders starting to be put into place and people resisting them. he went and said, you know, we need to desegregate this school. This is not, you know, there are 9 elementary schools and one of them is overwhelmingly Black. So he put forward a plan, a voluntary busing plan. Initially, it was a one-way plan. The Black kids get bused to white schools, but ultimately it was changed as white families volunteered their own kids to be part of it. And it became a two-way busing plan where white kids were bused into Moreland and Black kids were bused into a variety of other schools. So that was the beginning of school integration in Shaker.
And that was done without tension. This isn't a story of Boston and people objecting to that.
I mean, there were some objections. I went and read the letters that were sent to the school board, and there were definitely people who were against it, and they were just as racist as anyone else. So to be clear, there were racists living there, and they were unhappy. But there was a critical mass of people who supported it, and enough to overcome that, and it was passed unanimously by the school board, and it was implemented without any real, you know, nothing like you would see in a place like Boston. I mean, no, there was more like grumbling, I would say, not nobody was protesting or anything like that.
Once the elementary schools were more or less integrated, what happened with the high school de facto and in reality? What was the situation with integration there?
Well, so there's only one high school in Shaker Heights, so it was obviously perfectly integrated, and everybody was in the same school. So that's sort of the low-hanging fruit, right? But then the question became, are the classes themselves integrated? Now, Shaker had for many, many decades a pretty robust set of tracking or leveling where you would have different levels of class for different ability levels. And in fact, they were highly racially segregated in the sense that the highest level classes were overwhelmingly white, not completely, obviously, but overwhelmingly so. And the regular and lower level classes were disproportionately Black. So this was something that was noticed and complained about really almost from the beginning.
Yeah, and you have stories. I mean, the book is full of stories of people who lived it as the teachers, the students. You have one story of a father who knew that his daughter was having trouble in an advanced science class. So he said, I shall sit in the class and observe what's going on. The daughter's grades rose, but also the father pointed out to the white teacher who was receptive to his criticism that you're running this class in a way that's racist, a bit racist, that you're favoring the young jockish white boys and it's harder for Black kids to get called on. And the teacher even did a little self-reflection and said, that's true. I mean, it's an interesting story, but how could it be replicated, or were efforts like that replicated on a grander scale to reform the high school?
I mean, that was in junior high, to be clear. Okay. But yes, but still, the point holds. I mean, there were all sorts of stories like this. They're all this sort of implicit bias just really coursed through the system. I mean, I knew I would find stories of implicit bias when I set out to really start talking to people, but I was shocked by how many I found. Almost every Black alum, parent, student had a story along these lines to share. Sometimes there were little things, sometimes there were big things. And you know, I think they tried to address it in various ways, but not particularly successfully, to be honest. I think there have been problems that have persisted for a long time around that, about different assumptions being made. For instance, when kids, almost all of whom were Black, moved in from the city of Cleveland, they were assumed to need to go into the lower level classes because obviously the Cleveland schools aren't as good as our Shaker schools are. And so they must be in the lower level classes. Now, that might have been true for some of them, but certainly wasn't true for all of them. I talked to somebody who was in an advanced program in the Cleveland schools and, you know, very bright. And there was no need to put that person in a lower level class, but those were just assumptions made. That's just one example. There are many of them. And that's a real problem.
When did you graduate? Did you go to Shaker High School?
Yes, I did. I graduated in 86.
What was the reality and the thinking about the success of the school and if it was successful for everyone at that time?
So, you know, I think there were a lot of explanations slash excuses made for the achievement gaps that were present and for this disproportionate leveling that was present. There was often said that a lot of the Black kids didn't start in the Shaker school, so that's why they were behind. Or it was said that, Black kids may not be doing as well as the white kids, but that's because these white kids are uber achievers. You know, these are the kids of surgeons at the Cleveland Clinic and professors at Case, Western Reserve. Reserve, and these are like the top of the cream of the cream. So that's why, you know, they're just doing so well, but the black students are still doing much better than other black students elsewhere. So there was a lot of sort of explanations given. There may have been truth to some of that explanations, well, but yeah, it really didn't get at it.
There was an achievement gap, but it was much less than the country at large, right?
Well, for a while, it's hard to know because during those years that we didn't have the same kind of national data that we have now. But there was an achievement gap for sure. And it was one that was unsettling to a lot of people. And it was also, I mean, I remember looking around my advanced classes when I was in high school and seeing that how few black kids were there and wondering why that was the case. Although I think I assumed that everybody was getting a good education in whatever classes they were in because it was such a good school district.
Was it possible for an exceptional black student to benefit from all the AP courses and all the resources and being elbow to elbow with that surgeon's daughter from the Cleveland Clinic?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Then there were definitely a lot of high achieving black kids who went through the Shaker schools. Many, many, many. And they're all around the country doing wonderful things right now. So there absolutely was possible. And I will also say, even kids who weren't necessarily in advanced classes, a lot of them are doing really great now too. And they look back on their Shaker education as in a very positive way. So I don't want to paint an overly negative view. But there was this disproportionate leveling and there was this achievement gap. And I think the question needed to be asked, and it was asked over and over, you know, why is this the case in a very well-resourced district like this?
Mm-hmm. So from what I understand, the book sprang from a specific article that you were assigned in, or you took it upon yourself to report in 2019 about tension between a white teacher and a black student. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I actually started reporting the story first, and then I came upon this particular incident, which became the centerpiece of the story.
So that was where you started, you started reporting it, and that was your focus. But so I don't want to erase the, you know, 20 years prior, but were things really coming to a head around then, 2018, 2019?
Well, you know, this was a time when there was a lot of focus on these questions of equity. There had been a superintendent, the longtime superintendent had been basically kind of nudged into retirement because there were parents who felt he wasn't doing enough to address the achievement gap. A new superintendent had come, a black superintendent, young man, who had really rankled a lot of people, partly because of what he was doing and partly because of his personal style. And then he was gone, though. He just stayed 5 years. He was gone when this incident happened in 2018. So I think the community was thinking a lot. It was top of mind, these questions of equity and of, are black kids being treated the same? And are we giving everybody the same opportunity? All of that was very fresh and front and center when this particular conflict came along.
Right. So I just want to set the scene and bring the listener along. The situation was, here's a town. It was an exception among many other towns. They have always tried to do the quote unquote right thing when it came to racial equity, either imperfectly, you might say, or they didn't. And it was so imperfect as to be something of a failure. But here we are in 2018. And now tell me about this incident. Or 2019.
Well, it was actually the incident was in 2018. The story was in 2019. This was in an 11th grade advanced placement English class. There was a student, a black student, and a white teacher. The student had struggled a little bit early. This is early in the fall, and had struggled a little bit, and then had been kind of dozing in class a couple times, and came into class on this one particular day, and she didn't have an assignment that was due. And from the teacher's point of view, it was a red flag that, you know, she'd already seen some problems early in the year, and she wanted to kind of nip this in the bud, and she started asking her some really kind of tough questions and doing it in the room, in the classroom where other kids could hear, or at least the student felt like other kids could hear. Like, you know, what else are you taking? What did you take last year? Who was your teacher? How did you do? You know, just sort of a little bit in your face. And it was very upsetting to the student who sort of left the room and went to the bathroom, called her mom, you know, was in tears. The teacher realized right away that something had gone wrong and apologized, but and it looked like for a time that they would kind of smooth things over and things started to improve for this girl. But in fact, a couple weeks later, her mom was very upset about what had happened. She's very attuned to these issues of racial bias. And she filed a formal complaint with the district, accusing the teacher of bullying, which is against district policy, accusing her of suggesting she was guilty of racial discrimination. And that set off a weeks-long investigation. The teacher was removed from class without explanation. She was, you know, her email was cut off. She was told to not set foot on the campus. She wasn't allowed to tell anybody what was going on. This investigation dragged out, and ultimately, she was exonerated of the racial discrimination issue, but they found some other students who were upset about her approach as well, and she was reprimanded essentially with a letter for quote-unquote bullying. Anyway, this all comes to a head at a big community meeting, which was supposed to be about something else, but in fact, this was what was top of mind. And the teachers' union was furious because they felt like, hey, are we not allowed to have a conversation with a student? Are you not allowed to tell a student that they need to do better and not without being called or charged with bullying? And they showed up in force at this meeting and basically went at the administrators who were on the stage. And that was kind of the tone in the room for a while. And then the girl herself was in the audience, too. And even though her mom had said, you will be quiet, you will stay in your seat, she actually jumped onto the stage, identified herself as the person who was the one involved in this incident, and asked them these questions saying, you know, why do we have these problems? Why are there so few kids in advanced classes? And really the larger thing that this whole thing pointed to that fits with the larger Shaker story is, you know, when you are a Black kid in an advanced placement class and you're one of the few, it can be a lonely place. A lot of people have talked about that. So then when you're singled out, and if it's even worse, and then you feel like, well, if this is a district that's, you know, trying to do better and trying to get more kids to take these classes, you know, this doesn't seem to be the way to do it. So in the room, it kind of shifted in the tone with parents getting upset. So it was really also a very sad evening, to be honest, and a really missed opportunity for somebody to kind of, I kept longing watching the video of this, for somebody to stand up and sort of articulate the community's shared values and talk about a way forward. But sadly, nobody did. And this incident had some really lasting damage.
What did the school district wind up doing about it, stemming from this meeting and incident?
Unfortunately, they didn't do much of anything, to be honest. I mean, they did not really address it globally. Part of the problem was that there was an interim superintendent at the time, not a lot of great leadership, to be honest. The Prince High School principal had been fired and there was an interim principal. It was just a very kind of bad time for the district, but nobody really came through. In fact, the only constructive community conversation I know about was led by students in a group called the Student Group on Race Relations, which has been around now for 40 years. They have done really amazing work, and they actually led conversations with teachers about what had happened in the aftermath of this.
Laura Meckler is national education writer for The Washington Post. Her book is Dreamtown, Shaker Heights, and the Quest for Racial Equity. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And for Pesca Plus subscribers, we have more Meckler. Pesca Plus, it's not just an invitation to trivia. It's more astute journalism, in-depth interviews and conversations that you won't hear anywhere else, or at least you won't at this length. Go to subscribe.mikepesca.com to get an ad-free version of The Gist, which will save you time, and Pesca Plus programming, which will use up most of that time you saved. Subscribe.mikepesca.com. And now the spiel. Webster's Dictionary defines account as an act of defining the exact number of something, or a European title of nobility corresponding to an English earl. The Children's Television Workshop defines count this way.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
Larry Krasner adds to our body of knowledge attempting to define account with the statement, quote, account is supposed to be account, Krasner said. Account is not supposed to be a nap followed by falsely asserting a number you never counted. Ah, okay, so that's what a count is not supposed to be, which serves, perhaps confusingly, as a counterexample. The reason why the definition or conception of counts are in the news is that in May, two inmates escaped from the Philadelphia Industrial Correctional Center. This is distinct from the prisoner who escaped from the nearby Chester County Jail in southeast Pennsylvania in late August. We know Philadelphia has low clearance rates for crimes that are committed, but it seems that the entire area can't keep hold of whatever prisoners it does manage to collect. So, in their write-up, the Philadelphia Inquirer says of the jailbreak, "The unprecedented incident made national news and led to a series of embarrassing revelations for the city." How unprecedented was it? Seems to keep happening. Well, here are some of those embarrassing revelations. One, a cell door that the men were able to manipulate open was discovered. There was also a guard who fell asleep on her shift and some external motion sensors that had been turned off because they'd been continually detecting geese landing nearby. Geese. From Sully to Philly, they are thwarting human flourishing. And by the way, these escapees were bad guys. One, a man Hurst, though just 18, is accused of killing four people and critically injuring two others in three separate shootings in less than 3 months. I'll read from the Inquirer. One of those homicides occurred near the front gates of another city jail. In March 21st, police say Hurst killed 20-year-old Rodney Hargrove an hour after Hargrove had been released from the facility and was waiting outside for relatives to pick him up. By the way, police now believe that Hurst shot Hargrove in error. It was not the man he was targeting. Then there was this killing on Christmas Eve 2020.
Like most 20-year-olds, Daewoo Scruggs lived his life on Instagram. He recorded songs and videos to make people laugh. Tragically, someone killed him while he was recording a live video on social media.
Hurst ran up and shot him multiple times, police say. So the guards at the prison must have taken their duty to guard these dangerous individuals quite seriously. Or if they didn't, whichever guards sloughed off, were double-checked and triple-checked, right? No, totally not right. They napped on the job. They invented a head count. Here's another one. A hole in an external fence that the two men crawled through had been cut nearly 7 weeks before the escape and had been noticed by staffers at least 4 days before the jailbreak. Video from 4 days before the escape shows the guards looking at the hole and pointing at it, but it was not fixed. Wow. A hole in the fence at a jail. Yeah, okay, well, that's exactly the sort of thing that can be backburnered, right? Other priorities. You know, that really only rises to the top of a to-do list, parts of the fence being out, if your job is to say, I don't know, keep people fenced in. Oh, yes, that is the job of a jail. Next came two more fences, you know, after they crawled out the fence that was noticed but not fixed. The two prisoners came over a couple more barricades, and the prisoners scaled them, and those were supposed to be monitored by the sensors. But geese, this is where the geese came in. Krasner explained, when the geese landed, they were setting off the sensors, and when they were setting off the sensors, eventually someone decided to turn them off. Okay, that's annoying, but check out what happened next. They kept the sensors in place, and these sensors take the form of two very large poles right next to the fence. And guess what the prisoners used to scurry up and get over the fences? Yes, you're sensing where I'm going with that. It was the sensors. I would call that an irony, but an irony is when the exact opposite of the expected occurs. And I, at this point, I'm not expecting Philadelphia not to lose some of its prisoners now and again. Krasner described the dereliction of the guards by saying, quote, call it negligence, call it malfeasance, call it whatever you want. We are here to talk about a problem. Indeed you are. How about a clown car? Can we call it a clown car? A total shit show? I was going to go a partial shit show, but the center detail, no, let's go a total shit show. You think you're running a jail, you're really running an escape room. Maybe a little bit of a CrossFit studio thrown in. The prisoners, by the way, were eventually apprehended. The geese have reportedly fled to Canada and are currently fighting extradition. Mm-hmm. That's it for today's show. Corey Warr is the producer of The Gist. Joel Patterson's the senior producer. Michelle Pesca is CLFAO of Peachfish Productions. The Gist is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Peru, and thanks for listening.